This is the My New Norm podcast, and I'm your host, Barry Scott Young.
I taught a seminary class, and I used to always tell my students, I would say, you know, behind every face, there's a story. Behind every face, there's a story. And I would tell them, when you get up, you know, and you stand behind that pulpit and you're looking out over your congregation, you see all those faces. Just know that behind every face, there's a story. If you knew that story, it might not change what you say, but it's definitely going to change the way you say it. You're going to say it with more grace. You're going to say it with more compassion. That's what I found I was falling in love with my hospice patients, the opportunity to hear their story.
My name is John Vertife, and this is my story.
Welcome, John Vertife, to the podcast. John and I go way back, probably early 80s in San Diego on staff together. There's been many years since our last conversation, so I'm really excited. So I'm walking into this as a listener as well. John Vertife, welcome. How are you doing today?
Barry, it's so good to be with you and see you again. It's been a lot of years. You know, there's an old saying, out of sight, out of mind, but that does not apply here. You're a person that's been a part of my life, a significant part of my life, and we've shared a lot of stories and
I agree,
a lot of experiences along the way. So
yeah,
a lot we can look back on and laugh about, and
now we can laugh at it. John, exactly. Today, you're recovering from a major back surgery. How is the recovery going and what happened?
Yeah, the recovery is going well. I had a quintuple, whatever you would say, laminectomy surgery on my spine. Normally, a three-hour surgery, it ended up being 6 hours. The doctor said, I've never gone through more than one drill bit. He said, I broke five on your back. He said, you got a lot of strong bones. So I guess that's a good thing. I've got a strong back, and I guess, you know, maybe that's not just a physical reality, but maybe it's a good metaphor for my life and the things that I've come through, the things that I've carried. I think it's, maybe appropriate.
Well, John, I remember hearing some fantastic stories of you growing up. I want to start there, kind of your growing up years. What was that like? Where were you? And
well, I was in the middle of 10 children, so we grew up fairly poor. You know, my dad worked hard just to kind of keep shoes on our feet, and even then, the shoes we had weren't that quality, you know. always putting a sandwich bag on your feet so that when you walk through the snow, your socks wouldn't get wet coming up through the holes of your shoes. My. You know, we moved a lot. I was born in Connecticut, but we moved back and forth between the Northwest and Connecticut probably 5 or 6 times in my growing up years. And so we were always moving. It wasn't unusual for me to come home and there'd be a U-Haul attached to the trailer, and my dad had it all packed up, and whatever he couldn't fit in the trailer was in a pile in the middle of the yard, and he'd say, get in, we're moving. And I, you know, it's just like, hey, can we say goodbye to our friends? No, just get in. And we'd get in and we'd take off, and there wasn't room for the dog. So we'd have to leave Scruffy behind, you know, because he's got 6 kids in a station wagon. Off we'd go and look in the rearview mirror, and Scruffy's chasing us down the driveway. But, oh, he'll find a home. Somebody'll take him in, and we're crying. And we'd cross country that way. And, you know, my dad would start the trip. He had this saying, when we leave the The gas tank will be full and your bladders will be empty, and we won't stop until your bladders are full and the gas tank is empty. So we crossed country, and back in those days, when he got tired, we'd pull over the side of the road and get some blankets, and we just slept on the side of the highway. Semis whizzing by us, and it was just a different world back then. And so he was always wanting to get to that next destination. So it's like we're traveling down the road, and it's like, hey, you know, it's Mount Rushmore. Can we stop at Mount Rushmore? No, we got to get going. And so we cross country. I swear I crossed country at least 6 or 7 times and never stopped to see anything. Pass the Grand Canyon, pass all the sites. It was just stay on the highway and get to one place. And so we were all boys at the time before my sister was born. So to keep things moving, my dad would, he kept a mayonnaise jar in case we had to, you know, we had to go. And so, you know, with a bunch of boys, we'd be, you know, we filled that mayonnaise jar up pretty quick. And sometimes it would get so full that, you know, it had to be emptied. And again, dad didn't want to stop. So we're driving through, you know, Kansas or someplace, and it's like 100 degrees, and our shirts are off, and our backs are sticking to the vinyl on the back of the seat, you know, like Velcro. And someone would get the idea, like, it's time to empty this thing. And they'd try to, you know, slosh it out the window, and it all came flying back. My dad, he had this interesting physique because his left arm was always like really tan from hanging out the window. And his right arm was about 5 inches longer because he was always reaching back trying to swat a skid. So it was
no seat belts.
No seat belts, you know, but he just trying to find a place that you could claim for your own. And I remember, you know, cars would pass us on the freeway, and I'd look at the car, and maybe there was like a couple with one kid in the back seat by himself. And I want to be a part of that family. I was at camp one year. I was 16 years old. This is back in Connecticut. The camp was in Massachusetts. It was the middle of camp. I was at the snack shack, you know, hanging out with my friends. And all of a sudden I see this station wagon with the U-Haul coming down the road. I go, oh, no. My dad pulls up, you know, in the station wagon, the U-Haul, the kids and everybody, my family's in there. And he goes, we're moving back to the Northwest, so hop in. We're taking off. I go, I'm in the middle of camp. I got a great shot of being king of the camp. And Donna Brubaker is, you know, she's like the love of my life right now. And she might be queen. And like, I can't do this. So I said to my dad, I said, how about this? You guys drive out, and when I'm done with camp, I'll just hitchhike out. My mom and said, what do you think? She said, it's fine with me. You think he might have like pulled a 5 or a 10 or a 20 out. Here's some money. He just said, fine. And he took off. Camp was over, and I'm 16 years old. And now after they left, I looked down and, you know, counted all the change in my pocket. I think I had a $1.35 is what I remember. And I thought, man, I better hang on to this. So no more snack shack for the rest of camp. And at 16, I hitchhiked from Boston to Seattle. And I left with $1.35 in my pocket. And I arrived with $1.35 in my pocket. Had a lot of great experiences along the way. So
that was what, the 60s, 70s, right in there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a whole different time.
Yeah, it was.
But you lived through all that. When I met you, you were hired to be the college pastor in San Diego. We had a lot of good times in the one-way in office complex.
Well, you know what's funny about that is as dysfunctional as my family was, the churches we attended were even worse.
Oh no.
So we, you know, I grew up in a kind of ultra dysfunctional Pentecostal kind of environment, you know, very, very legalistic. Like, you know, I couldn't go to movies. We couldn't, you know, couldn't go to dances because all of that was of the world. And if you're of the world, then of course you're not for Jesus. And so, you know, I had to get a note to get out of the square dancing class for PE school. And, you know, so I'm sitting on the sidelines and everyone's out there square dancing. And it's just like, hey, Vertife, how come you're not dancing? I'm going, it's against my religion, I guess. The movies would come out like, hey, it's the Shaggy Dog. Mom, can we go see the Shaggy Dog? No, all my religious experience growing up, it was unhealthy. It was toxic in a lot of ways. So when I got to Faith Chapel, it was a different experience because, you know, the motto on the verse on the outside of the church was "Whosoever will may come." And that ability to embrace anyone who came through the doors was such a refreshing experience. Just to have that refreshing openness and acceptance and that door of grace, I was introduced there. There's a great musical called Les Miserables. I don't know. I remember going to see Les Miserables and just weeping. Because it was such a great metaphor of law versus grace. You have Javert, who's the law. He's after Jean Valjean, and he's gonna find him no matter what. And then they have Jean Valjean, who represents just grace and mercy.
Wow.
And that's what I found at our time at Faith Chapel together. Is I felt like I was transitioning from being this Javert, this who was so dedicated to the law and the rules and making sure all the rules were followed, to becoming this person of grace. And that was really, I think, my first introduction to genuine mercy and grace, even though I was in the ministry, even though I had already been pastoring churches, to find that grace versus law was life-changing for me. And it continues to be. The exciting thing I think about my life right now is that door of grace, it seems every year just gets a little bit wider, less judgmental and more whosoever will may come, the church, but it's about my own life, you know, welcome to my life.
How long were you there?
Well, I was there from, I think, 1986 to 2000. I started as the college pastor, working with young adults, and then became the associate pastor, and eventually I became the senior pastor, and I was pastor for 10 years. But with the grace of God, I did. And so for 10 years, we just tried to build a healthy congregation, and eventually, we got the finances back on board. We were able to, you know, burn the mortgage, pay off the church, and have a healthy membership. But it took its toll on me, for sure. And I think there's a lot of things I began to resent. And I got to the place where I think I just, you know, you talk about burnout. It's kind of an overused word, maybe. But I just felt like I had spent myself. And I felt resentful about what I was going through. Gotten to the place where I didn't want to be in the ministry anymore. I'd wake up and I didn't want to go to work. I'd drive home from work and I just wanted to just keep driving, just not stop, just get away from it all. Eventually I did. I resigned the church, probably not in the best way. I just made a decision and just said, I'm done. And so that was back in 2000. Moved away from San Diego. It just a whole lot of dominoes began to fall, including my marriage. And eventually I found myself, divorced out of the ministry and just kind of struggling to find my way. It was a tough season of my life. Found myself kind of resentful against God, you know, kind of just wanting to give up on my faith. In the course of that, being out of work and trying to figure out what in the world I was going to do, started to explore what could I do. I was working as a cashier at the Nordstrom Rack. I'd be, you know, in front of my little till, and someone from my congregation would come through to, you know, to buy a pair of shoes or whatever, and there I was, and it was just like so embarrassing for me. So, you know, I felt such shame that I'd fallen away from the things that I once held so dearly. So I started kind of figuring out, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And decided for some reason to look into the chaplaincy. And as I was doing my research, discovered that I could become a hospice chaplain, a hospital chaplain. required that you have a master's degree, which I had, that you had years of experience in the ministry. And so I qualified. And so I called the hospital here in San Diego. It's the largest healthcare system in San Diego, Sharp Healthcare, and talked to the person in charge of residency for chaplains. And she said, "Hey, we just had someone drop out and we have an opening if you want." I said, "Yeah, I'll take it." And so I was accepted into a residency. And what I didn't know is I didn't know that they paid residents for their training. And so, man, I found myself in a place where I was sort of still in the ministry, but I was meeting people one-on-one in hospital rooms. I discovered that I think this is the whole reason I went into the ministry for the first place. It wasn't to, you know, be the administrator of a $5 million budget and a, you know, 50,000 square foot church. It was really to connect with people, to people that were hurting. In that year of my residency, I was still in this angry place with God. We were kind of at war, but I found that the war was kind of moving to a detente, you know, and as I began to talk with people and talk about their spirituality, I found that my own sense of what I believed was kind of being challenged. And so I began to explore my faith and my spirituality in a different way. People would ask me, "Well, so what do you believe? And what are you now? Are you a Christian? Are you, what are you?" And I would just say, you know, I think what I would like to say is I'm a conversationalist. Conversation. I'm in a conversation with God, and I'm in a conversation with what my spirituality looks like. One of the things about chaplaincy is I didn't have to promote anything. When I was a pastor, you have all these people that have this agenda. It was like they were always wanting you to preach against something. And I was always like, and that was part of my frustration as being a pastor. They always wanted you to be against something. And I'm like, well, why can't we just be for stuff? You know, why do we always have to be against stuff? That's what I grew up in, was always being against stuff. What I found in the chaplaincy is that I didn't have to promote anything. I didn't have to defend anything. All I had to do is be present with people, explore their spirituality with them, and just be present, you know, the ministry of presence. It's interesting, like, you know, as a chaplain, you're getting clinical training. And so you have to enter a clinical note into every patient's medical profile. So it's not just, you know, this, some people think chaplaincy is just, you know, kind of a cop out of being, you know, you can't make it as a pastor. It's actually a very rigid training process, and it's a very clinical process as well as being a spiritual process. It's an interesting combination of things. And so you're writing in clinical notes about your interaction with patients. And one of the terms that we have that we can enter into our notes is this phrase called the ministry of presence. Mm-hmm. It's just about being present with people in a non-judgmental way, welcoming, opening, listening, and just providing that sense of, I'm here with you. You're not alone in this. And as a hospice chaplain, we talk about the privilege of sitting at the bedside of the dying. I began to realize that every single person that I meet on my caseload is going to die. And I'm dealing with a family that is also going to be experiencing the grief and the loss of someone very often very special to them. And so you're walking into a place in people's life experiences, you know, kind of at the end of life. Now death is a reality. Mm. It was interesting to me as I began this journey into hospice, just how afraid our culture is of death and talking about death and not seeing death as really a part of as part of life. We live, we die. We celebrate the birth and we you know, do the best we can in the life, but most of us are pretty unprepared for the death part of it. One of the things that's began to feel comfortable with, it was kind of interesting because growing up, I was always afraid of like older people. Like old people kind of scared me. Felt like I don't like being around old people. It just made me feel nervous. You know, for the most part, not always, but you know, a good deal of the patients that I have now, they're older people. You know, 80s, 90s. I've got a couple right. in their hundreds, and I've just learned to love, you know, people of age. And one of the great opportunities I have is just to hear their story. I have this phrase I use, and I taught a seminary class on homiletics, or the art of preaching. And I used to always tell my students, I would say, you know, behind every face, there's a story. And that's my saying, behind every face, there's a story. And I would tell them, when you get up, you know, and you stand behind that pulpit and you're looking out over your congregation, you see all those faces, just know that behind every face, there's a story.
Right.
And if you knew that story, it might not change what you say, but it's definitely going to change the way you say it. You're going to say it with more grace. You're going to say it with more compassion. And that's what I found I was falling in love with my hospice patients, is the opportunity to hear their story, because they want to share their story, because they want to know, was my life worth living? What did valid? Did I have any significance? Did I make a difference in life? And so in listening to their story, it gives them an opportunity to often affirm the life that they lived, and to know what they had to overcome and what they had to come through, and to affirm your life is significant. You matter. You matter to God. You matter to the people in this room, and that you're loved. I would just remind them, you know, that the greatest thing we're going to take out of this life is to know that we were loved and that we loved. That's a part of a lot of what I do, is just reminding people that they're loved and that they're cared for. It just makes such a difference in people's life.
You know, as I hear you sharing this, I think of the word compassion. I remember hearing that compassion comes from two words. It's from the gut with a panic to do something. And the word compassion to me kind of comes to mind in what you are and have been doing. It's that sense of one's coming alongside your sorrow and sharing it.
You know, again, like I just said, I think most people want to know that their life mattered. It's interesting to see the way people die, and to companion that in a way that is kind of on their terms, not my terms. You know, as a chaplain, I'm not there to promote what I believe. I'm not there to proselytize and tell people they need to get right with God before they die. Right. I'm really there just to companion their own spirituality, in which, you know, I've sat with atheists. I sit with Buddhists. I sit with Christians. I sit with Catholics. I sit with Muslims, the whole gamut of people's spirituality. And one of the things I try to do, whatever a person's spirituality is to find what is the redemptive element in your spirituality. Mm. It's an interesting walk. And again, often it's so funny, you know, I'll call someone and offer, you know, one of the services we offer through our hospice is spiritual care and support. Is that something you feel like you would want for yourself? And I don't need that. You know, I don't believe that stuff. And I talk with them a little while, and they say, well, if you want to come by, okay. You know, so I'd go by, and I would just kind of start a conversation, share your life story with me. I'd look around the room and I'd see what was in the room, and this is an interesting collection. Talk to me about that. And as they would share their story, is you create a bond. And it's a very strong, it's behind that face is a story. When you know the story, it makes all the difference. And there's a bond that begins to take place. And I just remember this guy is just this old, you know, kind of crusty, smoking, cussing retired sailor, you know, had spent his whole life in the service and, you know, couldn't talk without using the F word every other sentence. And just, you know, but we have this bond. I remember one day I got a call from his wife, and she said, you know, Gary feels like he's passing and he wants you there. And so I went and I came to his bedside and I sat down and I said, what do you need, Gary? He says, I just want you to hold my hand. That's what I did. Held his hand, died. He died knowing that, you know, that he was cared for. I think there was probably a lot of unspoken things going on in his heart that day that, you know, maybe I do need some of that spirituality. Maybe I do need a little more of John brings to the equation here.
When you think of the process of dealing with death as a one that's kind of left with the pieces, isn't there a level, different levels of things that you go through, you know, anger, shock, you know, those things? Isn't there a process that you go through before acceptance?
There is, I think, for the patient, for the family, and for me myself. It's one thing to go in and pray with somebody who's 99 years old and they lived a long life and they everything's right with God and they're, you know, and man, their death is like, wow, I'm really happy I could be there. Yeah. But then you have, you know, a 36-year-old mother with two kids with breast cancer and she's dying and there's nothing anyone can do. And you know, she's going to leave behind two kids and a husband. And, you know, those are the visits where sometimes I would just go out and in my car and I would just sit there and cry because I was grieving too.
Sure.
And of course they're grieving and walking through that whole process. You know, she's come to a place of acceptance. The husband is angry, you know, at God, and the kids are just lost. And so you're trying to help a family hold all of that, you know, in a space, a sacred space where people can process whatever it is they need to process. And often that's, you know, sometimes I become sort of the object of people's anger and wrath, you know, and they want to take their anger toward God or toward the situation and they don't know what to do with it. So they give it to me.
Wow.
And often it's done in an angry way. And so you sit there and sometimes I feel like my job is just to be like the sponge that I'm just here to absorb your anger. So whatever you need to get out, I'm here just to take it and let them process that. And I think that's a lot of what I do in walking with families that are in the process of going through that whole grief cycle.
Well, John, you are kind of appointed to be there as scaffolding, where you come alongside them, giving them strength. You know, you can't take it from them, but you can come alongside them.
Yeah, exactly.
And provide a source of stability and strength. The challenges and the ups and downs, all of that has tempered you to what you're doing now. You know, I just see God's faithfulness in your life, and it's remarkable.
Well, I think, you know, if there's any takeaway from today, it goes back to my mantra, behind every face is a story. I remember seeing a little video clip. This person gets on the bus and they're able to see the little thought balloon above everybody's head. And, you know, we get on the bus and we look at, oh, look at that person. And we make all these judgmental calls and man, why don't they dress the way they do? And why don't they smile? Well, whatever. But then you look at the thought bubble, which we can't do, but in this video, and just said, you know, just got a cancer diagnosis, going through a divorce, just lost a child. And again, that story that is behind the face, that's where the compassion comes from. If you just want to judge the face, you can do that. But when you hear this story, it makes all the difference. So, you know, I'll pull up to a red light and the person in front of me, you know, the light turns green and they're just sitting there. I used to want to just blare on the horn, out of my way, I got to get somewhere. Maybe that person just came from their doctor and maybe they got a poor prognosis and maybe they're just in another world right now because something tragic has happened in their life. You know, we just with my kids, every time we heard a siren, it was sort of a cue that someone's life was about to change. That's what sirens do. They remind us that someone's life is about to change. And whenever we used to hear the siren, we would just stop and pray. We'd be in the car or wherever it is. And God, someone's life is changing right now. And I pray that you'll be present.
I so appreciate your life. I can just sense the quiet strength that comes out of you when you're present with those that need it. John, is there anything you want to share as we button up this episode?
Grace over the law, you know. Just let the door of grace widen in your life. Don't push anything away. Accept everything. So often we want to push things away in our life, even the things that bring suffering. I've just learned that rather than push things away, find a way to receive them and then find what's the redemptive thing in this for my life.
Well, I want to challenge my listeners to go deeper when they are with their loved ones and friends, to not believe or entertain the narrative that goes on in their brain about them, but to really stop and consider what are they going through. And your ability to be present will allow you to demonstrate some of the comfort and compassion that's needed. I just think there's so much more that we need to understand about those around us and our part in their life, you know. So you've been a good reminder of that today, John. This is stuff we need to hear that you don't hear every day. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, Barry. And I think what you're doing is great. Because I think what you're doing is really kind of what I've been talking about, is you have people on, even if it's just, you could say it this way, behind every voice, there's a story. For you to bring that story out, I think it's the most relatable thing that we have with another human being.
Yeah.
We share our story and we go, wow, his story is kind of like my story. If he can make it, maybe I can make it.
Didn't you find when you were teaching, you studied, you took notes and you shared, and it was good. But as soon as you shared a relatable experience or story, you could just sense the room tuning in, because it was something that wasn't found in your notes. It was found in you. I think
and that's where people connect.
The
story is, it's all about the story. It's so important. Another thing I used to do with my students is, you know, because they think they're going to become preachers and they think every sermon they're going to preach is going to change the world.
Right.
I'd ask them, I'd say, you know, name three sermons that radically changed your life. And they just kind of sit there and they couldn't think of one. I'd say, now name three people that changed your life. And boom,
exactly
like that, they can name 3, 4, 5, 6 people that radically changed their life. Why? Because of the relationship, because of the story, because of the connection.
Thank you for allowing us to do this today so I can share you with my listeners. And we will talk again.
Okay.
All right. Love you.
Jeremy.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Now you can help support this podcast with as little as the price of a cup of coffee. Go to www.ki-fi.com/mynewnorm. Thank you in advance for your support and interest in this podcast. Until the next episode, this is the My New Norm podcast. It's all about real people and real stories with your host, Barry Scott Young.